the world around me blurs. And then Annie stirs in my arms just a little and moans. Ayla senses her rider rousing and cries out, a pleading screech full of anguish. It is a profoundly intimate cry. I feel the hair raise on the back of my neck at the sound of it. I am, in this moment, only an intruder. Ayla, Annie murmurs through their pain, lovingly. It's enough. Ayla lets out a final shuddering convulsion, and dragonfire fills the sky. The arena, when we descend close enough to hear it, is roaring. I don't immediately understand why. And then I remember, Kallipolis has a sparked fleet. And a first rider. Rematch, I tell myself. I'm clinging to the idea desperately, because the alternative, that this is how it has happened, that these were the terms on which I won, is too nightmarish. They'll give us a rematch, they'll have to. I'm still riding Ayla, and though I dare not attempt to guide her by rein, Palor flies ahead of us, and she seems content to follow. Annie, unconscious once more, is limp in my arms. The cheering continues unabated as we land on the Eyrie. There, at least, people realize something is wrong. I descend from the wrong dragon, cut Annie free, and pull her off Ayla's back. The medics are ready with a stretcher. I carry her the few feet to it and lay her in it. When we remove her helmet, her eyes are closed, and what remains of her hair is drenched in coolant.
Lee, it's all right. She'll be all right.
I only realize from the way people are saying this that I have lost all composure.
Lee, Goran says quietly, you've got to go up to the palace box. They're waiting.
Please, let me stay with her.
You can find her as soon as you're finished. Right now, Kallipolis wants to see its first rider.
No, we need a rematch.
That's not how it works, Lee.
Please, please, not like this. The crowds are chanting, Lee saw Palor, first rider. The title I dreamed of hearing as a child, appended to my name. For a moment, the irony of my victory is so bitter it is almost a taste in my mouth. That dream has come true now, years later, in a wholly different world and against all odds. But all I want in the moment is to undo it. Goran grips me on the shoulder and his tone hardens.
In the name of Kallipolis, pull yourself together.
I dry my face as I mount the stairs to the palace box. Afterward, I make a single detour before finding the palace infirmary. I go to the Lyceum, to Tyndale's office, and I slip a note under his door. The words I've written on it come with the ease of premeditated thought, and I write with the same blazing certainty that rose to guide me as I leapt from Palor's back. I was told you await my letter. Here it is. By the time you see this, you'll know that our fleet is sparked, and the Protector's answer. Kallipolis will not bow. You wrote me once that you hoped I would know the feeling of the might of the world at my feet. Today I have known it. Your choices are your own. My conscience is not your keeper. Bring what fury you have, and I will answer it with ours.
Annie.
In and out of sleep I take in the nights and days of an unfamiliar room, a single familiar figure sitting at my bedside throughout. Dressings are applied and removed, and time passes fitfully, through a haze of pain. But in one of the lucid moments I wake to a single half-heard sentence of dragon tongue, passed in its entirety by my sleeping consciousness, and now fully intelligible. Lee told Tyndale, I have nothing more to say to them. I return to sleep, with the utter exhaustion of complete relief. When I finally awake, I'm in pain. Slowly the world focuses. I know it after all. An infirmary room where I've lain before, though never with bandaging this extensive or constricting. The window is open, letting in the summer sunlight and breeze. Vases full of flowers fill the space of my bedside table. Seated next to the bed, slumped over in an uncomfortable-looking chair, is Lee. Lines of care have smoothed on his face as he sleeps, though the bruises of exhaustion beneath his closed eyes remain. How long have I been here? How long has he been here? Memories of the match are returning in flashes. The gut punch at the sight of that letter from the ministry. The steel-hardened spillover with Ayla. The aching relief of finally sparring with Lee Sir Palor again. The mounting anticipation of triumph. And then, dragonfire. Like the memory of an old nightmare and pain. And then Ayla needing me and Lee, still there, holding me. That memory is jarring, doesn't fit. How? But the memories are there, impossible. Lee behind me, astride Ayla, his fingers fumbling for the valves on my coolant shafts. His hand on Ayla's side, comforting her as she struggled to spark. Because it's not only my memories that contain him. Ayla's do too. And I remember her fear and anger at his intrusion and then, as he soothed her by touch and by words, her surrendering trust. My throat has gone dry to remember it. Then I realize how he must have done it, and exasperation battles with tenderness as I look at him. You stupid, fearless flyboy. Lee stirs, sits up with a start as his eyes snap open. The lines of care return to his forehead and mouth. He looks at me and sees I'm awake. His face fills with relief. Hey, he says. But he says it bashfully, and I realize he's nervous, shamefaced. It takes me a moment to understand why. I'm all right, Lee, I tell him.
I'm so sorry, he says hoarsely. Annie, I never...
I laugh and it hurts, so I stop. He notices, his eyes widening in alarm. It's not your fault Palor sparked. Lee is shaking his head, like that's not enough.
I asked for a rematch, he mutters, looking down. But they wouldn't.
I'm smiling, though this hurts in a different way. Why would they? I ask. Pain is filling Lee's face.
Because you deserved to win.
My throat tightens to hear the words said. To hear them said by Lee. I struggle to put words to the feeling overwhelming me. To call it something other than disappointment. Struggle to explain the victory, stupid though it was, that meant everything to me. The little part of it that had nothing to do with Lee, or Kallipolis, or anything but myself. It was good to really want it. I didn't know I could want something that much, and to believe it should be mine. And now this is what it feels like when you let yourself want something fully and fail to get it. I'm swallowing, willing my vision to clear. Lee is looking at his lap. Anyway, I add, it's probably for the best. You were the one they wanted. Lee twitches, drags his fingers through his hair, and then he reaches into his pocket and produces a letter. Crumpled, seal broken, but I recognize it at once.
I went back while you were sleeping. It didn't say what we thought it did.
He hands the note to me. I open it and read the single phrase within. Antigone, go show them what you're made of. Miranda. And that's how I learn that consolation has the power to hurt too. I hadn't imagined this bitterness of disappointment could intensify until it did. To see the words finally written, the affirmation finally given, that I've craved and struggled for as long as I can remember, and too late. All I want to do, all my body wants to do, is pull my knees up against my chest, wrap my arms around them, lower my face and sob. Lee is staring at the floor, haggard with shame and guilt, and although I know he'd leave if I asked him, I also know there's more to say. So I run my thumbs under my eyes, gather my composure, and tell him what he needs to hear. The thing both of us need to hear and remember. You'll be beautiful at it, Lee. My exoneration from its depths. Lee's eyes are bloodshot as he raises them to look at me. Beautiful. This boy who has grown into a young man, who is ready to become a leader, who's through it all been my best friend and the bravest person I've ever known, whom I will trust to the end. My voice is shaking as I add, and it will be my honor to serve as your alterna. The past is behind us, the war ahead, and our fleet is sparked. That's what matters. Lee reaches out, and when his fingers take my bandaged hand, I don't pull away. For a moment, we're both still, feeling the pulse between our palms in the silent infirmary ward. Lee speaks first. Now his voice is the lowest murmur. Annie, I need your help. I need you to. Report Tyndale. I already did. Lee blinks. My heart is racing, but I keep my voice and my gaze steady. After I overheard, I wasn't really sure what I'd overheard, but I knew. My fingers stiffen, still in his. I knew I didn't want you talking to him anymore. To them anymore. That was the gamble. Tyndale, not Lee. And now I know I gambled right. I have nothing more to say to them. He rubs his forehead and exhales slowly through his mouth, realizing the danger narrowly missed in retrospect, as though realizing that I could have just as easily reported him. I put the report under my name, I go on. And I filed it under speaking out against the ban, so it shouldn't jeopardize you. The re-education committee should process it within the week. Relief is washing over Lee's face. Thank you, he says hoarsely. I couldn't. I know. The next words seem to come choked out of him. It's going to get bad, Annie. Soon. I wonder if he means for Kallipolis or for himself, because I realize, looking at him, it will be both. Now that nothing stands between Kallipolis and New Pythos but Dragonfire, Lee's choices coming home to roost. I can think of no consolation to give besides confirmation of the course. Then it's a good thing our fleet's sparked.
Chapter 12. Palace Day. Lee.
Annie is discharged from the infirmary a few days before Palace Day. Because I've been promoted to fleet commander, she's promoted to Aurelian squadron leader in my place, and I hand her the badge for her uniform myself. The fleet commander's medal has already replaced mine. A bugle within the silver and gold entwined circlets for the first rider. An Aurelian dragon, wings spread, for the squadron leader. She accepts it with a gracious smile that doesn't hide her shuttered disappointment or undo my own clenching guilt. Since the tournament, three more dragons have sparked. Though it's not enough to begin to consider offensive measures, particularly against New Pythos, so naturally well fortified, it's still enough to change the mood of the city. Kallipolis can defend herself again. The turn of sentiment, timed as it is with the arrival of Palace Day, means that the parade and its celebrations take on new significance for the Ministry of Propaganda. A chance to harness the hope of the people and cement it into readiness for war. But the parade is also the focal point of the Defence Ministry's security concerns. Tyndale has vanished into the bowels of the prison that the Re-Education Committee shares with the Ministry of Information, indicted for sharing sentiments contrary to the national interest. Despite the fleet sparking, the purge of the Aurelian cycle remains in effect. Copies of the poem are confiscated across the city. Lotus's father's library is among those raided. The Guardian's library is the only collection besides the Protector's exempted from the purge, but we still have to attend the bonfire. As I watch the flames turn pages into leaf-like fragments rising on the breeze, the words of the cycle itself return to me, bitter as smoke tasted on the wind. To you, ashes and final flames of my own, I stand witness. I who have escaped neither peril nor pain in your destruction, if it is our fate to die, then by my own hand let me earn it. 3 days before Palace Day, I'm shaken awake by Kor. Such was the nature of my dreams that I've lunged half out of bed, halfway to my feet, with legs still tangled in blankets, before Kor pushes me back down. It's all right. You were just waking people up, I realize. That doesn't happen much anymore, but around Palace Day, all bets are off. The dorm is unnaturally quiet, the usual snoring gone silent. The nightmares I've woken from are fresh enough that screaming is still echoing in my ears. The blankets are sweat-drenched. My face is wet. Thanks. Sorry. Was I? It's pressured speech. I have hardly any idea what I'm saying. But at Kor's whispered answer, I sober instantly. His face and expression are impossible to make out in the darkness. You kept saying no. I realize then that his hand is still on my shoulder. Thanks, I say again, shrugging it off. In his class with the Fourth Order later that morning, Atreus passes out identical battered booklets that all have the red stamp of banned material across the fronts. I read the title and feel myself break into a cold sweat. A True Account of Palace Day and the Red Month by R.T. Palace Day is an opportunity for great patriotism in our country, Atreus says. A time for the people to unite around a narrative of a beginning that erases the past and starts again. But it is also a time for the four of you to consider the burdens that will be asked of you as rulers. While we encourage the rest of the city to enjoy the story of Palace Day, I would like you to consider the facts. The booklets in front of you, published not long after the revolution and banned for the sake of political stability, provide a more than adequate summary. Please take a few minutes to familiarize yourself with the contents before we begin discussion. There aren't enough booklets to go around. Kor and I are sharing. When I don't move, Kor takes the book and begins to flip through it. I'm determined not to look at Annie, or Power, or at the book at all. So I keep my eyes on Kor's face, watching his eyebrows knit together as his eyes travel down the page. His breathing hitches. He continues reading with his hand gripping his mouth. By now, I've had years of practice sitting through classes about the revolution and the Red Month. I've learnt how to keep my face impassive and count the seconds. Anything can be survived for an hour. But few teachers have spent any time talking about Palace Day itself. And when they have, it's never been with the facts laid out so explicitly. When Kor finally looks up, his face has gone green. He starts pushing the book toward me in case I want to take a turn reading. I close it and push it back at him. Atreus breaks the silence. Kor, would you read from the top of 14, please? Kor flips to the page and the others follow suit. He begins to read hoarsely about the fate of the Aurelian Triarch and his family. I feel the classroom fade in and out. By the time he gets to the second child, Kor's voice trails off. Atreus doesn't ask him to go on. Kor looks up. Did you know? Did you know it would be like this? Atreus's smile is all steel. One never knows, he says. But the cause of popular uprisings are fairly predictable. We knew that the people would be difficult to control once they were allowed inside the palace walls. Atreus pauses, allowing the confession to sink in. Then he goes on. It went further than we wanted. I admit that. But even so, it was a risk I knew we were taking from the start. It was a hard decision, but it had to be made. Better these deaths once. Atreus drums his fingers on the booklet in front of him. Brutal as they were, than countless more undeserved deaths in the future. Do you agree? Silence. The pulse of blood in my ears. The sound of a room of people saying nothing. Power speaks first. I don't think it would have been a hard decision. Atreus's response is cool. You don't? None of this is worse than what they did to us, Power says. Blood for blood. The words echo oddly in my ears. I can feel Kor glancing at me, and it is only after a moment of paranoia that I realize why. This is the sort of thinking that I usually push back against. Then I hear her speak. You think they deserve this? I know Annie too well not to recognize the sound of her anger. Power says, Yeah, I do. After what they did to us, they deserved it. Annie snorts. After what they did to whom? The Janiculum? Power hears the incredulity in her voice. His eyes narrow, his face suddenly contorting as he leans forward, his voice lowering. My mother was from Cheapside. I'm a Cheapsider. The Highlands weren't the only part of Kallipolis that suffered, Annie. As far as Cheapside is concerned, the Dragonborn got what they deserved. It's the first time Power has ever outright admitted to being anything other than patrician, much less a Cheapsider. Kor's eyebrows have shot up as he studies Power's screwed-up face. Annie's voice is shaking. What they got wasn't justice. It was a massacre. I raise my eyes from the stained oak table and finally look at her. Her hair is cropped now, the burned braid cut off after the match. It hangs in jagged chin-length spikes, like an urchin boy's. She's glaring at Power and has begun to flush. I hear myself speak. You, of all people, should think it was justified. Annie's eyes move to mine. Peripherally, I note the others shifting, uncomfortable, catching the reference as well as Annie has. Atreus clears his throat to intervene, but before he can, Annie speaks. Her voice is unexpectedly thick. What kind of person do you think I am, Lee? My throat closes. Atreus breaks the silence, his tone impatient. Antigone displays admirable compassion for her enemies that Lee and Power would do well to imitate, he says. It should never be easy to decide who dies, even if, as in this case, they were guilty of terrible things. As you may know, before the revolution, I was chief advisor to Arcturus Aurelian. The fates that Kor just read to us were those that met his family. Annie inhales deeply and slowly as she understands. Atreus goes on with tranquil calm. Some wonder, knowing that connection, if I precipitated such violence against Arcturus and his people for personal reasons, if he had wronged me in some way, if it was an act of vengeance. After all, many revolutionaries were so motivated. Here Atreus nods graciously in Power's direction. Power twitches and eases back in his chair. Atreus's voice remains distant. In my case, it was not. In my case, in fact, I had every personal reason to support Arcturus. He had been good to me when I needed help, sponsored my education, and seen to my advancement. But in the end, what he did for me personally was not enough to undo the wrongs he committed as a ruler. And on those grounds, I made my choice. The good of my people over the pull of my emotions. Kor's fingers are drumming nervously on the table. Annie's eyes have widened. Power's lip is curling, his arms folded as he looks at Atreus with what might be disgust. But the commonality between their reactions is horror. As if what Atreus describes, a cool reckoning unmotivated by personal vendetta, is the most unsettling of all histories. I feel something else. Relief. I'm not the only one to have chosen this kind of path. Once, long ago, Atreus did the same. Atreus says,
I will live with the burden of Arcturus's death and the death of his family for the rest of my life.
Then he raises his eyes and a hardness enters his tone as he adds,
That does not mean I regret them.
Atreus gives our silence a moment before making his final point.
Much of what you'll be doing as guardians will be deciding which is the lesser evil, who lives, who dies. It will be, it should be, a terrible burden. Times may come when you question yourself. On those occasions, remember that these decisions are better made by you than someone else. If everything goes to plan, you'll be the most rational, the most well-trained, the most fit to rule. It will be your duty to make these decisions, to bear the guilt of them for others' sakes.
It's still a little strange to seek Chris's company privately, now that the First Rider tournament has passed and training for it no longer provides the excuse or the justification. But the desire to continue outweighs the reasons to call it off. Thought you wouldn't come, she says when I find her in her dorm room. The room is golden in the afternoon light. Chrissa is seated at her desk, where homework and stolen refectory mugs are piled across the surface, folded into her chair as she leans over her reading. The other girls have obligations right now, and we have the dorm to ourselves. I went for a walk. I throw my book bag on the floor next to her bed and sink onto it, leaning back against the mound of pillows and closing my eyes. The bed smells of the sea breeze and something just a little sweeter, a fragrance I've come to associate with Chrissa. Is everything okay, Lee? It's a checking in tone, the kind I use with others but can't remember anyone ever having used with me. I'm so unprepared for it that I don't know how to answer. I thought maybe it was because you were worried about Annie after the First Rider tournament, but now she's better and you're still... She trails off. I have opened my eyes and am lying very still, looking at her, but she keeps her gaze on her reading. Still what? I prompt softly. Sad, she says. She does look at me then. I know, her words are careful, like delicate steps across ice, that maybe there are things that happen to you that you can't, that are too hard to talk about. And I know that I know nothing, nothing of what it must have been. But if there's anything you want to tell me, any way I could help you. The public bio, the one she knows, is that I lost my family during the Red Month. The Triarchy created so many slum orphans in its last throes that the story has always gone unquestioned. I imagine telling her that the worst day I've ever lived is commemorated annually as a national festival and celebrated with a parade. That rather than taking comfort with what family remains to me, I've chosen to throw in my lot with their usurper. When I say nothing, she rises and climbs onto the bed beside me. Although I make no move to turn to her, my body feels like it is weighted to the bed like something apart from myself. She curls closer, fits her body against mine, and lays her head against my shoulder. She stretches her arm across my chest, spreads her fingers across my far shoulder. She is, I realize, holding me. One day, she murmurs into my shoulder, when we're at peace again, I want to take a few days' leave and bring you with me. Home. To Harbour Town, to see the beaches. She's phrased it like this, I realize, so that it's not a question, so I'm not given the opportunity to say no. It sounds so nice that I hear myself answer before considering the words. I've been there, once. Really? She sounds surprised. It takes me a moment to remember why. Orphanage field trip, I add numbly. It wasn't an orphanage field trip, it was a family vacation. Sand in our hair, fiddler crabs under our feet, the smell of fresh fish roasting over a fire as servants turned the spit. My sisters buried me. You liked it? Yes, I tell her. Very much.
Annie.
The day I'm discharged from the infirmary, a parade planning meeting is held with Miranda Hain, General Holmes, Lee, Core, power, and myself, and concerns the question of national security during the parade. At the sight of Hain, my stomach does an odd flip, remembering her note. I'm still stiff from the many bandages beneath my uniform. Sitting still is uncomfortable, and the feeling of my absent braid is disorienting. "Did you know," Hain says before the meeting starts, "that the title Alterna bears a feminine ending for the first time since our earliest poetry because of you?" Alterna is a dragon tongue loanword, and dragon tongue, unlike Kalish, is a gendered language. Even though I did know it, I also appreciate Hain's bit of trivia. Delivered softly and with a smile for what it is, something between congratulations and condolence. "Thank you," I tell her, and hope she knows I mean her note, too. Hain begins the meeting by requesting as many dragons as possible in the cavalcade going down the triumphal way. General Holmes, though he maintains the need for air patrols during the event, is inclined to allow it. "The security of the city's my main concern for this event at any rate. Keeping the bulk of the riders armed and central will only strengthen its defense." Lee has been staring with an arrested expression out the window at the fire mouth. The light is grey. A low layer of stratus has settled over the city, leaving those concerned with its air defense full of unease. Cloud cover like this is a defending dragon rider's nightmare. Lee never looks particularly well rested, even at his best. But at this time of year, the bruises under his eyes are always especially dark. The lines around his mouth deepened, as if sleep is something he has forgotten. "And the coast?" he asks Holmes, turning from the window. Holmes nods appreciative and throws a grin at Hain.
"Circumspect, our new first rider. I like that."
Lee responds with a twisted smile. Hain and Holmes begin to argue over the breakdown of the coastal patrols. Lee doesn't interrupt them again. It is determined that two air patrols, one over the city and one along the northern coast, will be deployed simultaneously with the parade, each led by a sparked dragon.
"I'll lead one of the patrols," Kor says. "Don't much like parades anyway."
The dragons who have sparked so far are in our highest ranks, Kors, Powers, and Chrissas among them. Lee says, "I'd like to take an air patrol as well." Hain looks at Holmes and says,
"That's not necessary, is it? I was assuming Lee would lead, along with the Alterna."
"I'd lead what?" Lee asks.
"The parade," Holmes says. "That's fine, Miranda. Seems appropriate for the first rider. All right, Lee?"
Lee's face has gone perfectly blank.
"Yes, sir," he says.
Palace Day dawns blue-skied. The fog cleared. The guardians are approved to participate in the parade. The booklet from Atreus's class has remained in my backpack, untouched, until the morning of Palace Day. Then, at last, I give in. The day is too incongruous, the excitement of the rest of the corps in anticipation of the upcoming parade, the feeling of festivity in the air, and the quiet composure with which Lee eats breakfast. He goes off on his own after that, as he always does on this day. As usual, I'm the only one who notices. And I think, I've had enough. It's time. Today might be a day when the whole city pretends, but I, for one, am ready for something else. Lee has leapt from one dragon's back to another for my sake, is preparing to endure celebrations that have gutted him every year since we were children, and after this, his path will likely get harder. I owe him an end of pretense and acknowledgement of the truth. the whole truth. I go to an empty classroom, shut the door, and open the booklet for the first time since class. I turn to the page I've been purposely skipping every time I leafed through. At the top is a picture of the Drakkark, of the Far Highlands and his family. My eyes are drawn immediately to the father, and I find myself staring, for the first time since it happened, at him. Even though the quality of the image isn't particularly good, I still feel the same mingled terror and hatred. He stands next to a woman and they're surrounded by children. They look happy and beautiful and proud. Pictured among his family, loving and fatherly, it's difficult to imagine him doing what I once saw him do. I look at the text below the picture and search for the name of the youngest child. There, 5 years old at the time of the portrait, a boy named Leo. I stare at the name, and for a moment, I forget to breathe. Then my breath returns in a rush. I search for him and see him there, grainy and unclear, but recognizable. The description may say that this boy is dead, but I know that he's very much alive. Even though it seems like I've always known, it still hits me like a physical blow, seeing him there at last, pictured 3 feet from the other man. For a moment, the page blurs. Then I blink my vision clear and force myself to read. I read about what happened to his mother, to his brother, to his sisters, finally to his father. I match every single face in the picture to the descriptions below. I slowly, meticulously imagine the scene that must have happened on this day 10 years ago. Then I look again at the picture, at the little boy whose face is just a few smudges of ink. Even with these limitations, it's plain to see that he's smiling. Most of the rest of the family aren't. Their expressions are solemn, dignified, befitting a formal portrait of a dragon lord's family. But it seems the artist made an exception for the boy, for an older sister too, who sits beside him. They're both smiling merrily, as though they're about to break into laughter. I realize that, in all my time knowing him, I've never seen Lee smile like this. It comes to me then, a vision of what he must have been, once. A youngest child in a family full of laughter, at the center of their joy and attention. Affectionate because he received affection. Talkative because if he wasn't, he wouldn't be heard. Probably prone to mischief. Because he could get away with it. It is easy to imagine him this way, though I only have a picture to base it on. After all, I was once the youngest child, too. Then I imagine this smiling little boy losing everyone he loved in the span of a few heartbreaking hours. I don't need to imagine what the pain must have been like, because I remember it. In that moment, it doesn't matter to me who his father was or what he did to me. All I want is to find the little boy I knew in Albans and hold him. Annie? I look up. For a moment, I think it must be him. And I realize the book is out, open, and it's too late to hide. But it's dark. Haynes waiting, he says. The pre-parade briefing. Remember? Right, I say. He doesn't ask what I'm doing, though I see him glance at the book in front of me. Bewilderment crosses his face as he recognizes it. I close the book, put it in my bag, and get up. Side by side, we make our way to the oration room. Hayne is waiting to brief us at the sunken rostrum in the center of the floor. When Duck and I enter, I realize we must be late. Everyone else is already in the elevated, rickety wooden seats that rise in concentric semicircles. Or almost everyone is. Lee is missing too.
You didn't find him? Hain asks Duck.
Oh, Lee, I think. Don't lose courage now. Not over a stupid parade.
No, says Duck. Do you want me to go?
But before he can finish his offer, the door opens again and Lee comes in. One look at him is enough to know that my fear was needless. If I notice that he's a little pale, a little tight-lipped, it's only because I'm searching for it. I'm struck instead by his marshalled self-possession. He's standing especially erect, his expression full of calm confidence. He's dressed in full ceremonial regalia, and he wears his cloak and armor as though he was born in them. The wings of the Fourth Order on his shoulder, the First Rider's ceremonial bugle slung across his back. Instead of taking a seat like the rest of us, he goes to stand beside Hain. He doesn't apologize for being late. Instead, he nods to Hain as if to indicate that the meeting may begin. I look at him, quiet and dignified and in complete control, and I realize that the hurt, lost boy I remember is just as gone as the smiling one I never met. He's put both aside today, and he needs none of the comforting that I'd like to give him. The thought fills me with fierce pride. Hain looks at him, once, measuring, and I can tell that she's noticed, as I have, the way he assumed power in the room as he entered it. And she's startled, though not exactly displeased. Then she clears her throat and begins to outline our route. As she speaks, and I continue to regard Lee, I allow myself to see it. The resemblance that's haunted me, that I've resisted for as long as I can remember, but that today I have confirmed past ignorance or denial. I look at Lee and see Leon Stormscourge's son. Atreus, mounted on a slate-grey warhorse, leads the way along the triumphal way, followed by the cavalcade of the crimson-clad Protector's Guard. Palor and Ayla come next, leading the rest of the aerial fleet not on patrol. Flashes of what I just read kept returning to my mind, and I find myself sickened by the festivity around me. The Kallipolan flags waving, the banners and fanfare, the cheering crowds. All seems like more and more hypocrisy. The crowds press close to us as we move forward, leaning against barriers constructed and maintained by the city guards. And we move so slowly that we have ample time to study the faces of the people cheering us on. Where once I used to number myself among them, now I find myself looking upon them with the same aversion with which I once looked on the Dragon Lords. I watch them cheering themselves hoarse over a massacre, and remember how, years ago, they hurled insults at a helpless dragon, even after it had been bound and mutilated, for the sheer pleasure of humiliating an animal that had only followed its master's orders. I remember being lifted on the shoulders of people in the same tavern outside, which, a month later, my service to the city was mocked. I remember how it felt, the wet, cold splatter of a villager's spit on my face. Atreus's words afterward. The anger of the people can be often cruel and ill-placed. These are not my people. I am not one of them, not anymore. These people understand justice only as revenge. They are undeserving, ignorant and cruel. It goes on, these thoughts, this mounting anger, until it crystallizes into one overriding feeling, disgust. Then with a jolt, I wonder, Was this how the Dragon Lords thought of us? Next to me, Lee guides Palor with agonizingly slow, careful steps, setting the pace for the whole parade. I glance at him periodically, every time seeing his still, calm face, mask-like and hard. Only in his posture does any sign of strain show. He sits straighter and straighter as time wears on, stiffening a bit more every time the cheering swells with his name. By the end, he is rigidly upright. Others might perceive this as a sign of pride, but I know the truth. It is the posture of someone receiving a beating and determined to get through it on their feet. The parade finishes in the people's square, separated from the palace by the river and a wide stone bridge. By now, it's dusk. The parade was timed so it would end with the kind of light best suited to demonstrations of fire. Lee and I mount the dais where, years ago, Leon Stormscourge's dragon was beheaded. Our dragons fire upward into the deepening blue sky, then launch into the air. Behind us, two by two, the other riders follow. We circle each other, the sparked dragons firing in formation, the others weaving around us. We can see the city stretched below, the masses in the main square, in the streets gathered to watch us, cheering as one. Then at last, it is over, and we depart for the caves. Back in her nest, I take my time scrubbing down Ayla, feeding her from a bucket of meat the caretakers left waiting for our return. Since sparking, she's developed a taste for charred meat, though half the time she overcooks it. When she ends up turning a leg of mutton into a big block of cinder, she attempts to eat it, gags, and then looks at me reproachfully. It's not my fault you can't figure out your own cook time, I tell her. It's a relief after the parade to do something as familiar as having a staring contest with Ayla. Hey, Annie? It's Duck's voice from the cave corridor outside. The coastal patrols must be back. How'd it go? I ask. Duck shrugs. Not so much as a sighting, he says. He waits on the threshold of Ayla's nest, a black silhouette against the tunnel's lantern light. Some of the others are going into town to see the celebrations, he says. Do you want to go with them? No, the last thing I need is more celebrating. Or we could go for a walk, he adds, seeming to sense my reaction. This I favor. There's nothing like a walk around the palace gardens with Duck to make everything a little bit better. Okay, let me just finish up here. Sure. I turn back to Ayla, registering his leaving the mouth of our nest out of the corner of my eye. It's only as I replay it that I realize Duck was heading off in the direction not of the armory, but of the lower caves. I drop the bucket and take off after him at a run. I don't even stop to think why I'm running. All I know is that it's urgently important for me to stop Duck. More time has passed than I realized. He's just at the mouth of Palor's nest when I stumble up to him. He's on the verge of looking inside when I catch him by the shoulder silently and twist him around to face me. I'm shaking my head violently, and for a moment, Duck opens his mouth in surprise, and I think for a split second that he's going to say something and give us away. But before he can speak, another sound comes from within the nest. Retching. The splat of wet on rocks. Lee is throwing up. Duck realizes what he's hearing and closes his mouth abruptly. I stand frozen with sudden shame. Even hearing Lee right now seems like an invasion. For a moment, Duck's eyes linger on my face, and I sense the question there, unspoken. Why did you expect this? We make our way in silence from Palor's nest.
Lee.
I had hoped the armory would be empty when I came up from the caves, but instead I find Krissa and Kor stripping along with the rest of the riders from their patrols, faces flushed and hair windswept. I summon up the energy for a single word. Anything? Krissa and Kor shake their heads. I should be relieved, but instead I feel something almost like disappointment. Let them take us. Let it come. On Palace Day, I want the world to burn, and I care very little who sets it afire. But aloud, all I say is, we should rotate out riders and send another guard up. I'll take it, Kor says. I'm not tired and you look like shit. Krissa gives him a reproving look and he shrugs, unabashed. I know this is my cue to refuse and take my turn in the air, but tonight, in the wake of the parade, I don't have it in me. After I've seen them out, I go to the cloister library and pull the Aurelian cycle from the shelf. It now bears a stamp of banned material across its front. Aside from what we go over in class, I haven't looked at it in years. It's strange to read it. I remember it as something that was chiefly spoken aloud. Spoken aloud by him. When he told it to us in riveting installments after dinner, before bed, it was always from memory. He never needed a book. Now, reading it silently in the empty library, I can hear his voice again. It's been a long time since I've let myself remember it. Time passes and I hardly notice. I just keep reading, skipping to the parts I like best, flipping backward and forward through the pages as I recall parts I want to revisit. I work my way inward toward the part of the poem that's been most on my mind, the part where the lost island of Oreos is overtaken and burned, where the Aurelians are finally defeated and driven into exile. Sometime around 1 a.m, I summon up the courage to read it. I hear the words in my father's voice, and the voices of the characters become the voices of my family, till it's all a little blurred, but still with that separateness, like a shield. I feel the old grief and don't feel it. I'm caught somewhere in the middle, between these words and the real things. And then they are around me, half stories, half real, my family. Though we are no longer in the part where they are being hurt, we flip back to earlier pages. It's dinner, my mother is refilling my father's cup. Lee, she says. But that's not my name, I think. And that's not my mother's voice. Around me the dinner is fading, my sister's laughter is growing fainter, and then I hear the name that is not my name again. I open my eyes and look up. In the half second that it takes for Annie's silhouette to come into focus, when I've recognized her but not quite woken, there's a surge of the old bitterness. For that instant, I think, it's always like this, you standing between me and them. But then the bitterness dulls, takes its rightful buried place. In the dim light of the lantern I've been reading with, I take in her expression. Her face is tense, set. Her expression is enough for me to anticipate her next words. I close the Aurelian cycle without looking at it. There's been an attack, Annie says. South, over the Median, under the cover of yesterday's fog. We've been summoned to the inner palace.
Chapter 13. The Median Attack. Lee.
Despite the late hour, the windows of the inner palace are lit. Inside the council room, Lotus and Warren, the two skyfish riders whose patrol must have just returned bearing news, wait with Atreus, General Holmes, Miranda Hayne, the chief treasurer, and the ministers of trade and agriculture. I take the constituents as confirmation of my fears. The Pythians didn't strike our military, our navy, or our aerial fleet. They didn't even try to attack our city. They went for our trade fleet. Atreus gestures for us to sit, not on the side of the room, but at the table with them. How bad? I ask. Holmes, with assistance from Lotus and Warren, begins to debrief us. Multiple airstrikes, all within a window of about an hour yesterday evening, when the fog still hung low. South along the Median trade routes between Harbour Town, Deimos, and Basileia, where our patrols rarely venture. Given the number of attacks, their distance apart, and the descriptions returned by the Navy, more than a half dozen sparked dragons were involved. Nearly our entire trade fleet was lost, and with them, most of this year's textile exports. The casualty count of Gallipolan civilians lost at sea will number in the hundreds. But that's only where the devastation begins, the Minister of Agriculture starts to explain. With so many farms incentivized from subsistence farming to textile exports, Gallipolis no longer supports self-sufficient levels of food production to sustain its growing urban population. And with the exports destroyed, there are no profits by which to make up the difference. The Minister of Agriculture doesn't say famine because he doesn't have to. So that's how it will go, reaping fear not with dragonfire and blaze sites, but with the slow pressure of hunger through the winter. And we, with our half-sparked fleet, will be able to do nothing but endure it. You wanted the world to burn. Now it's burning.
We can borrow, can't we?
Atreus turns to the treasurer.
We're looking into it. Mithridates and others will help as much as they can, but many of them lost huge investments in the attack.
What if we centralize our food resources for the winter and redistribute?
Atreus asks.
It might be enough, the Minister of Agriculture says, looking frightened, but there's really no way of knowing up front how much we would have. And that sort of operation is very difficult and has disastrous effects if mismanaged.
Atreus asks,
do we have alternative solutions for supporting the urban population through the winter?
Silence answers him. Atreus closes his eyes, his face twisted in deliberation. And then he opens them. He turns to Holmes.
Begin collectivizing resources immediately. I want every village, every farm upturned for whatever it's made this harvest. We'll centralize resources and ration from the city center.
My mind latches onto a single word, collectivize. Surely he doesn't mean. Atreus turns to us.
Shift the skyfish to coastal patrols exclusively and keep a minimum of one spark dragon accompanying them. Devote the Aurelian and Storm Scourge squadrons to assisting with collections.
He does mean it. Collections. A practice notorious in the old regime that hasn't been implemented since the revolution and was infamously enforced by Dragonfire. The Dragonlord's preferred method for collecting their harvest taxes. My father's usual occupation in autumn.
You're asking us to...
The traditional methods. Speed will need to be our priority.
Traditional methods. Words so easily delivered by Atreus, an order so dismissively given, that for a moment I don't even believe I've heard it. Because of course for Atreus it's just that, two words. For me, for the other dragon riders, it will be something else entirely. Which is why Atreus is able to look so calm, while I go lightheaded. Annie beside me is swallowing audibly, her hands clenching on the table, her eyes widening as the order washes over her. Watch how this vision will splinter. I hear myself say,
Yes, sir.
How soon can you start collecting?
Atreus asks Holmes.
First light, Holmes says. I'll need to speak with the first rider and Alterna to arrange matters.
The general conducts the meeting with me and Annie in his office and on his feet. We agree to launch a strengthened guard tonight over the city. Tomorrow morning, ground forces will begin collecting food from the countryside, accompanied by two dragons per visit.
I think it's best if you go on the first collections, Lee, Holmes says.
For the first time since our meeting began, Annie speaks.
No, I should.
She's white-faced, gripping the arms of her chair with tight fingers. Holmes takes in her expressions and his own softens.
Antigone, collections are going to be very difficult.
Annie's voice is faint but clear, each word spoken with crisp precision. I know what collections are like. Holmes blinks, the composition of his face shifts with understanding. As far as I know, Annie twitches. I'm one of the only guardians who knows what collections are like. Lee's never. Here she stops, and with a pang, I understand her sudden hesitation. She's wondering if I've been on collections before too. I shake my head. I was always deemed too young to go along. Annie inhales a catching breath and straightens. I know what you're looking for. I know what you'll need. I feel a coldness entering my bones. Whatever Annie knows about collections, there's only one person she could have learned it from. Holmes places his palms on his map-covered desk and it creaks beneath his great weight as he leans forward. Knowing what I need isn't the same as being able to do it. This kind of operation is only as successful as it can be harsh. They'll think we're lying about giving it back, that we're just collecting it for ourselves as the old regime used to do. We're going to have to crack down hard, especially at first. I need riders who can do what it takes. Annie's voice is faint but clear. I can do what it takes. For a beat, they stare at each other, this towering man, the girl a third of his size, eyes blazing. Holmes seems to find what he's looking for. He removes his palms from his desk and straightens. Good, he tells her. Then you'll do the first ones and begin training the others after that. In the hallway outside, Annie stands stock still for a moment and wraps her arms around herself. Then she releases them and we begin to walk. The palace is quiet, dark, and full of the earthy smells of early autumn as we match stride through the courtyard arcades. Who do you want assisting you? I ask. Annie's answer comes without hesitation as a murmur. Rock. Of course, Rock is a former serf too. You'll need to talk to him after I debrief the Corps, and the two of you will have to begin training the rest after tomorrow. All right. I realize the other thing that will happen tonight, as if a stone has dropped into my gut. I'll also need to speak to Chrissa first before we wake the others. Why? Her father is a trader and he's at sea. In the cloister, I follow Annie to the darkened girl's dorm and count the beds to Chrissa's. Then I say her name. She follows me into the hall, rubbing sleep from her eyes. Lee, what's... you nut, is this a tryst? In the sconce-lit corridor, she turns out to be smiling. That easy, unlabored Chrissa smile that I've grown to cherish and am now about to take away. But I can't do it here, in the hall where she passes every day to and from bed. Nor can I imagine doing it in the refectory, or the solarium, or the courtyard. Wherever we have this conversation, Chrissa will remember it for that. So I take her hand and lead her to an unused classroom in the library wing. When I close the door after us, she's still smiling. This is pretty irregular, Lee, but I can make it work. Would you mind sitting? The smile flickers. Doubt finally enters her expression. She sits, and I sit beside her. Has your father's ship sailed into port yet? Not for a week or so, I don't think. Why? In the time it takes for me to form the words, her face stills. Like all the pieces that didn't add up to a date are now adding up to something else, and then, as I knew it would, the smile goes out. No, she says. No, no, no. I'd thought experience would be a kind of preparation for this conversation, but it turns out that there's no preparation for watching someone's face struggle to understand a new kind of pain. Nothing's certain yet. We only just got the news. We don't know anything for sure yet.
What news?
Annie.
When the guardians are assembled, alert and curious, in the sconce-lit oration room, I ask Cor to come with me to find Lee. We can hear Chrissa crying from the corridor. Inside, he is sitting with his arm around her on the old-school pew, his face lowered into a hand. Annie, Cor, Chrissa says when she sees us and gets to her feet. Cor's voice is rough.
Hey, how are you doing?
Not great. Lee has risen with her.
Is it time?
He asks me. I nod. Lee tells Chrissa.
I've got to speak with the others. Cor can wait with you here.
Chrissa wipes her eyes. No, I'll come. None of us are expecting this. When she sees our expressions, she lifts her chin. I have a squadron that needs me. What do I have to hide? I'm not ashamed to be seen in grief. Inside the oration room, she sits between me and Cor. The double takes that riders have when they see her tear-stained face seem to make no impression on her. Lee takes his place behind the rostrum in the sunken center of the room. In the time it's taken to return to the oration room, he's become charged with burning energy, like a pent-up dragon finally released from its cave, and the Corps notices. Silence falls.
I'll keep this brief, Lee says.
It's the first time Lee has ever officially run a meeting with us as fleet commander. He explains what happened, what we'll be doing for the next few weeks, and what he needs immediately. It's over in 10 minutes. He heads out with the first patrol, taking a third of the riders with him. The rest of us are dismissed to get some sleep. I pull aside Rock to talk to him about tomorrow morning. When he realizes I'm asking him to assist in the first food collections, he pales.
I remember collections, he says.
I do too. That's why we should do them first, then train the others. Rock lets out a low whistling breath.
Uriel's dragon, he swears slowly.
I tell him what I've been telling myself ever since that conversation with General Holmes. It won't be like before. We'll give it back.
Even if we do, he says, shaking his head, there won't be enough.
Rock keeps pretty well informed about the state of agriculture in Kallipolis, and the way he says this makes me nervous in a way even the Minister of Agriculture's predictions didn't. We don't know that yet, I say. Rock grimaces, like there's something sour in his mouth. It's our best option. Even if there isn't enough, this is fairest. But even as I say it, numb dread fills me at the thought of what's going to happen tomorrow. Rock turns away, pulling at his mouth like he's working through something, and in the end he just utters a single expletive.
When do we leave?
He asks me. 6 in the morning. We should go to sleep. Rock lets out a hollow laugh at the suggestion.
Chapter 14. Collections. The children were given a quarter of an hour after the choosing ceremony to say farewell to their parents. The boy and the girl watched from the side of the room as the other's parents wept, embraced their children, and made promises to write. Maybe we shouldn't do it, he said. She looked at him like he was mad. Of course we should do it. This is the best thing that's ever happened to us. The next thing needed to be said very carefully, and he had been choosing the words for it all afternoon. I know you think the people who used to have the dragons were bad, he said. But what if the new people are bad?